Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A frustrated nation contemplates its government ground to a halt.
This is Jerry from Baxter Springs, Kansas. In my opinion, the only way to get the two gangs in Washington to figure out what they're doing is to make them realize they are gangs. And they need to get together.
Putting the pieces back together is going to be hard. Maybe a constitutional overhaul is in order?
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare.
Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
And secure the blessings of liberty.
Retro TV evoking some futuristic politics. We're holding a constitutional convention this morning. We have the technology. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, February 26th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by Lynn Scherr this morning in for Celeste Headlee. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
The takeaway is, you know, after a week of frustration in our series Frustration Nation, we're going to talk about amending the Constitution this morning, how that might work.
That's scary, a constitutional convention, but let's get to some other top stories that we are following this morning. And first, here's what you need to know about yesterday's healthcare summit. House Minority Leader John Boehner gives us the Republican side.
Let's start with a clean sheet of paper, and we can actually get somewhere, and we can get it into law here in the next several months.
Well, not so fast. For Democrats, Senator Jay Rockefeller says the first step to better healthcare is reining in insurance costs.
The health insurance industry is the shark that swims just below the water. And you don't see that shark until you feel the teeth of that shark.
Near the end of the conference, the president told Republicans that if they cannot compromise, Democrats will move forward with the bill with or without their support.
We cannot have another year-long debate about this.
And to pass the bill, Democrats would have to use a very special budget process called reconciliation, which forces a majority vote.
Reconciliation might break the deadlock, but perhaps Congress needs a bigger solution. The U.S. government needs a bigger solution. We're going to talk about that in just a moment, but we're joined now by Nate Persily, professor of law at Columbia and friend of this program. What does it take to amend, upgrade the Constitution itself, Nate?
Well, there are two routes specified in Article 5 of the Constitution. One is that whenever two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the House and the Senate, deem it necessary, they can propose amendments to the Constitution, which then get ratified by three-fourths of the states, either in their state legislatures or in the convention. The other route, which has never been successful, is that two-thirds of the state legislatures can ask that a convention be called, and then the amendments from that would then be ratified.
All right, well, keep your own amendment in mind. We're going to talk about how we might end gridlock by amending the Constitution in just a moment, Nate Persily.
In other news, the streets of Kabul were a battleground this morning. Suicide bombers triggering a series of explosions and gun battles that killed at least 17 people in the Afghan capital. The target was a row of hotels used by Indian embassy workers. The Taliban is claiming responsibility.
The U.S. took both the gold and silver in the Nordic combined at the Olympics yesterday, but the women's hockey team lost in the gold medal game to Canada. And the American women's figure skaters left the games without a single medal. Heavy favorite Kim Yoon-na of South Korea took gold. Asian and European markets are up at this hour. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,234. Coming up this hour, we're following the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake. We'll talk about how Miami has been taking in thousands of Haitian students later in the show. All this week, our series Frustration Nation, we've been talking about gridlock in Washington and how to fix it. Today, how would you amend the Constitution to make government work better? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. And The Takeaway's Constitutional Convention is now in session. Stay tuned.
Your
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry, and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Yes, in Frustration Nation yesterday, Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee this morning, you could hear them kind of trying to achieve bipartisan consensus at the healthcare reform summit yesterday, sort of.
I definitely think there was an effort. I think that for some of the posturing that was there and all the gimmicks, did you know, you saw they had stacks of bills and papers and
charts.
The president sort of called them on that, which I thought was pretty interesting. But there did seem some individuals who did want to talk about it.
Well, here's a Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican of Tennessee.
And my request is this, is before we go further today, that the Democratic congressional leaders and you, Mr. President, renounce this idea of going back to the Congress and jamming through on a partisan vote through a little used process we call reconciliation, your version of the bill.
But the reconciliation majority vote scenario looks to be the one the Democrats are going to actually use to pass something in 6 weeks, the president said yesterday. And here's why, says Democrat Henry Waxman of California.
Mr. President, you're not going to be able to do this piecemeal. And I have doubts about whether the Republicans are going to help you, because I haven't heard a lot of willingness to come and work with you now, or did I hear it a year ago?
So there you have it. Not much of a compromise, a lot of intent, bipartisanship, not a whole lot in evidence out there in Frustration Nation. Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, joins us. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning.
And Melissa Harris-Lacewell is associate professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University. Good morning, professor.
Good morning.
So, Nate, let's talk about amendments to the Constitution. If people are frustrated with the lack of an ability to get things done, even if we are divided between the two parties, is there a constitutional amendment solution, and how would we get there?
Well, if you think passing health care is difficult, amending the Constitution is even more so. And it requires either action from the Congress, so you need two-thirds of each House to pass an amendment that's referred to the states, or you need three-quarters of the state legislatures to recommend a constitutional convention.
So it's worse than the 60-vote majority in the Senate. It's two-thirds. But couldn't the Senate just change its rules on the 60-vote cloture rule without a constitutional amendment?
That's right. But that itself would probably be subject to a filibuster. And so it would require that they allow for a majority vote to overturn the filibuster rule, but it's probably likely that the Republicans would filibuster that change.
All right, I'm dreaming you into a constitutional convention, Nate Persily. What amendment would you pass if you could do it tomorrow to tweak the Constitution?
Well, ironically, the amendment that I'd like to pass is the one that actually the Constitution says you're not even allowed to pass, which is the Constitution, even though it says you can amend it, says that each state shall be guaranteed two votes in the Senate. And actually, the Senate is the most unrepresentative body in, you know, our electoral system. And that is, in many ways, the source of the problem.
And getting more so based on the population shifts in the United States. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. What do you think the threshold is for talking about constitutional amendments based on, say, the history in America? Certainly the race question moved from politics into the constitutional amendment question a number of times through our history.
Sure. But let me say, I don't think we're anywhere close to that, where we are right now. So I appreciate that all week you all have been talking about the Frustration Nation idea. But frustration is about right, and frustration is not a crisis. Listen, the notion that gridlock or that inefficiency is in and of itself a problem, I think we should pause. Our founders, in part, created a system that is meant to be inefficient, that is meant to not move forward quickly. I can solve gridlock for you with a good authoritarian dictator, right, who just passes rules that the dictator would like, to pass. But that's sort of
you
not
have one
goal.
In mind. Do you have one in mind?
Yeah, sure. Look, I'd love to just, I'd love to run the country if I could just run it. I certainly don't want to be president and have to compromise with anybody. But if you want to make me dictator for life, I'm happy to take on the job. I'll get you some health care.
But right, you know, so Commissar Lacewell, isn't it true though that the rules that preserve the minority's voice in, say, the Senate have morphed over the last generation to be much more obstructionist than they were originally intended to be?
Absolutely. And I do think, again, that frustration is appropriate. It's just that when we start amending the Constitution, we're in a situation that is not just about frustration. It's meant to be something that is more crisis-provoking. For example, the question of slavery, which, of course, divided the nation in a four-year civil war, and in many ways, the legacy of which continues to divide the nation. I mean, this anxiety about the Senate, I think, is an appropriate one. I'm not sure that I would do away with the Senate, but I certainly would like to see the end of the Electoral College, which in some ways is also about the Senate. It's also about the fact that states are overrepresented in the Electoral College in the choice of the president, because, of course, every state is guaranteed that two Senate voice in the context of choosing the president as
and,
well.
And it makes the election a numbers game as well as a referendum on what the people think about. To both of you, but Nate, I'll begin with you. Alvina, one of our listeners in Western Kentucky, says, we should have a parliament-styled government where the president can dissolve the parliament if the Congress is not productive and order new elections. There's a constitutional amendment. What do you think of it, Nate?
One of the problems right now is that we have parliamentary parties with a divided government. And if you had a parliamentary government where basically you just had one house of Congress that would be dictating the rules, then you could vote the bums out and you would know what the consequences are. The problem now is that we have cohesive parties that are highly polarized, but we have a governmental system that doesn't allow one party effectively to run its policies through the system.
All right, Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. Harris Lacewell, isn't there a problem, though, that if there is too much frustration and things don't get done in traditional mechanisms of government, that there's impetus to move towards a dictatorship, even in the United States, before we go?
Well, I think the real issue is what voters will do, whether or not they will punish the GOP for being obstructionist or punish the Democratic Party for not getting things done.
And they've got the pictures to actually make that case from the healthcare reform summit yesterday. Melissa Harris Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University. Also, thanks to Nate Persily up there at Columbia. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check out on some other stories we're following.
In Afghanistan, at least 17 people were killed today when several suicide bombers attacked a hotel popular with foreigners in the center of Kabul. Eyewitness Dr. Mohammed Aziz described the scene to our partner, the BBC.
We heard, first of all, a very massive explosion which shattered all the windows across the office where we are working as well as we are residing. After that, we heard two more explosions probably within a few minutes of the first one.
Afghan police say they have killed two of the attackers and are pursuing the others.
Here in the U.S., as we mentioned, President Obama sparred with Republicans yesterday during that all-day debate on health care reform. The president says he's not sure Congress can come to a bipartisan consensus.
Is there enough serious effort that in a month's time or a few weeks' time or 6 weeks' time, we could actually resolve something? And if we can't, then I think we've got to go ahead and make some decisions, and then that's what elections are for.
Democrats say they will reassess the situation next week. At the Winter Games in Vancouver yesterday, Canada beat the U.S. 2-1 in women's ice hockey. But Bill DeMong took gold in the Nordic combined event. That's a cross-country skiing event. Here's his teammate, Johnny Spillane, who won silver.
And it was just a matter of trying to get into a spot where we could get first and second, and whoever was first and whoever was second didn't really matter all that much.
The games wrap up on Sunday. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, more Frustration Nation, but your advice for young people who are just becoming voters. How would you keep coming-of-age students from getting too cynical? Your voices in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee for a few days here with John Hockenberry. Hi, John.
Good morning, Lynn.
And now it's time for some takeouts on stories we've been following. Representative Charlie Rangel was one of the last to speak at yesterday's healthcare summit. And shortly after it ended, he was greeted with some very unwelcome accusations by his colleagues in the form of an ethics investigation. Here is Congressman Rangel.
The report further finds that Representative Charles B. Rangel violated the House gift rules by accepting payment for reimbursement for travel to the 2007 and 2008 conferences.
And that, of course, was Charlie Rangel talking about himself and what the accusations are. We are joined now by the Takeaways Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, in Washington about this. Todd, this is not good news for the congressman.
No, it's not, but it's better news than he might have expected. I want to take it one step further, Lynn. These are not accusations from the Ethics Committee. This is a conclusion that Charlie Rangel, who is extremely powerful and one of the most senior members of the House, did violate House rules when he allowed a nonprofit to pay for a trip to the Caribbean that he and several other members of Congress went on. That was, the nonprofit was backed by several major corporations, Citigroup, Pfizer, Verizon, AT&T, companies like that, that Charlie Rangel knew or should have known that that major corporate sponsors were backing this nonprofit that paid for his trip. That's a violation of House rules.
And Todd, this is not a new set of problems for him. This has been going on for some time.
For some time, and it's not the only set of accusations against him. Charlie Rangel is also under investigation for allegedly improperly using his position as a senior House member to raise money for a Charlie Rangel Institute at the City University of New York. There have been no determinations on those accusations made yet.
And we will keep following this and see what turns up. Thanks, Todd, in Washington. John?
Of course, Charlie Rangel, head of the Ways and Means Committee. That's a huge power shift in Congress if he has to go. We turn now to the Olympics. Take out Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, out there in Vancouver one more time. We talked about medals earlier this morning, Jason, but it seems to me one of the things that has dominated this game is Lindsey Vonn, this great skier, great U.S. skier, but it's more her narrative rather than the emotional content of what's her narrative that's dominated the games rather than her actual skiing. What do you think?
It's an interesting notion, John. You know, going into the games, she was very much the face of the U.S. delegation. She was planning to compete in five events in alpine skiing, considered a medal contender in at least two of those. And so much has happened to her. Before the games even began, she announced that she had a shin injury that might hold her back. It looks like she's going to compete in all five events. The last one is today. That's the slalom. She's not considered a strong gold medal contender there. She's had some conflict with a teammate, Julia Mancuso. They've competed against each other for a long time. They came up in the same system.
Let's talk about the Vonn versus Mancuso. Here's Lindsey Vonn talking about her sort of emotional stakes in this whole games.
It's amazing. I mean, I've given up everything for this, and it means everything to me. It's why I work hard. It's why I'm in the gym, and, you know, my family's here supporting me, and it's just, it's awesome.
You know, do some of the other members of the team feel that it's Lindsey that gets all the emotional support and maybe they're left in the shadows?
Some of Mancuso's comments have indicated as much. There might be a little bit of a resentment mounting that it seems to be all about Lindsey Vonn for these Vancouver Olympics. Mancuso has the same number of medals. She has two silvers going into the slalom on the final day.
That's interesting. Okay, so Apollo Ohno, how was this games for him?
Apollo Ohno, he has to be happy. He's 27 years old. His aspirations probably are not what they once were. He goes into the last day of competition in short track, having achieved what he set out to achieve in these Vancouver Olympics, and that's come away with the most total medals for an American Winter Olympian. He has seven, and he has a chance to win probably one more in the 500 meters. He's also in a relay, the 5,000 tonight. Americans not expected to do particularly well there.
And is his future endorsements or maybe as an urban messenger? I mean, he is a speed skater.
Who knows what he's going to do? You know, he's been on Dancing with the Stars. He's a charismatic character. And if he does retire from short track, I have to imagine he'll be in the public eye going forward.
Well, he's a blur on skates. And Jason Stallman, thanks so much for being with us this entire Vancouver Olympic Games.
Thank you.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, our own Olympic takeout athlete. Gold medalist, I'd say.
John, our final takeout comes from our lovely listeners. You, all of you out there, heard part of our week-long series, Frustration Nation, just a few minutes ago. But we got some good feedback from you on yesterday's installment. If you're a high school civics teacher, how do you teach good governance with congressional gridlock? And what about if you're a student?
Politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done.
Oh, wow, that's cynical. That's one of our guests yesterday, Amina Green, a junior at Detroit School of Arts. And to that cynicism, we got some advice that everyone can do.
This is Glenn Maxwell in Detroit. What we have to do as citizens, we vote every 4 years, but in between that, we need to let our representatives and our senators know exactly what we want from them. But you can call, you can write, and you can email your senators and representatives, and it makes a big difference.
Hillary agrees on our site, thetakeaway.org. She posts, citizen action does work. I would like to see students learn more about this. They should be encouraged to speak out and find out they can really make a difference, as they saw during Obama's campaign. And one person said maybe 18 years of age is not the right age for voting.
Because people of that age aren't paying taxes, they don't own property, they don't have children, they aren't married. So none of the things that a real tax-paying voter has to deal with are having to be dealt with by these 18-year-olds. Yet they all feel that they should have a say. And I'm not saying they shouldn't. They need to wait and have a proper say.
But they do go off to Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know if I buy that one, but call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Haitian American students entering into Miami schools after the earthquake.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee for a few days. And coming up, we're following the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake. We're going to talk about how Miami has been taking in hundreds of Haitian students. That's in a few minutes. But here are some of the news stories we are following at 30 minutes after the hour. After hours of debate between Democrats and Republicans, the health care battle remains at a standstill. President Obama says a compromise might not be possible when it comes to covering the uninsured.
With respect to the most contentious issue, I'm not sure we can bridge the gap.
Near the end of the conference, the president told Republicans Democrats will move forward on the bill with or without them. And the gridlock doesn't end there. The Senate did not extend programs for laid-off workers yesterday, jeopardizing millions of unemployment benefits scheduled to expire over the weekend.
This morning, Vice President Joe Biden is proposing legislation to protect workers' retirement savings. The goal would be to get rid of the conflicts of interest on the part of financial advisors. Under the vice president's proposal, advisors and money managers will have to base investment advice on objective computer models, and they won't be allowed to steer workers into funds that they are affiliated with. New Orleans police called it a dark day for the people of the city after a news conference yesterday set out the details of a police cover-up. Following Hurricane Katrina, two people were shot dead by police on a bridge in the city. Earlier, we spoke to Steve Engelberg of ProPublica, which helped investigate this story.
This incident on the Danziger Bridge was a very well-known incident. In its immediate aftermath, as we've now learned from this plea, there was a pretty massive cover-up.
In all, six people were shot on the bridge that day. Big court win for Microsoft this morning. For the first time, the software company says it has won approval to secretly shut down a global network of computers that it says fired off more than a billion spam emails a day. The judge in the case allowed Microsoft to disable the network, known as a botnet, without warning the people running it. And Apple's iTunes hit a landmark this week, its 10 billionth downloaded song. And the song was...
You asked me if I'll get along. I guess I will some way. I don't like it.
Who would have thunk it? Guess Things Happen That Way by Johnny Cash. And in case you're wondering, the most downloaded song so far is the Black Eyed Peas' I Got a Feeling. My kids are responsible for probably about half a billion of those. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ starts trading at 2,234. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's a month and a half after the earthquake in Haiti, but the shock waves still reverberate far beyond the battered island nation. They are especially strong in South Florida, in its schools. With an estimated 21,000 Haitian-American students, Miami-Dade schools have felt the impact more perhaps than any other district. In the past month, hundreds of school-age students have left Haiti and enrolled in school in South Florida schools. Hundreds more have needed counseling and special care. We're joined now by Delphine Gervais, a counselor at Miami Edison Senior High School. Good morning, Delphine, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
You are a trust counselor, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
So you help students deal with all kinds of emotional issues, peer pressure, drugs, teen pregnancy. How has the earthquake in Haiti changed the kinds of things you're dealing with?
Well, first of all, I'm located in a school that is predominantly Haitian, Haitian-American descent students. So the impact from the earthquake was immediate, and it's still an ongoing thing. We've had to do from anything from large group assemblies to classroom presentations on grief and loss, as well as the many ongoing individual counseling that we've had to do with students.
And you are Haitian-American yourself, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm actually a graduate of Edison Senior High School, and this community has been home to me for many years.
So a very special connection there. We are also joined by Alberto Carvalho, the Miami-Dade County School Superintendent. Good morning, Mr. Carvalho.
Hi, good morning.
I understand you are just back from Haiti. Would you tell us something about what you saw there?
Well, I led a delegation of educators and infrastructure experts to Haiti last Thursday for a needs assessment. Obviously, we took a tour of the most impacted areas, specifically schools that were destroyed by the earthquake. I think everybody's reaction was one of disbelief, shock, just a horrifying experience. I can tell you that when you drive through streets where every third house collapsed, and when you come upon a school building that used to be five stories high, where 600 children died, and as they're still removing bodies from the rubble, they're burying them directly in what used to be the playground. Mm. It certainly is a humbling experience, and it forces all of us to elevate the priority of children in Haiti as our own priority, and that's exactly what we did during that trip.
I know that you have taken in quite a number of Haitian students, students from Haiti as opposed to the Haitian Americans, and our partner WLRN Radio in Miami recently spoke with some of the Haitian students at Felix Varela Senior High School in Miami.
We interact with them, but it's like we prefer being with other Haitians. Like, we feel more at home.
L'union fait la force.
Yeah, together we're strong.
Together we're strong. Alberto, how is your school system dealing with all of these new students? Are they sticking together? Can they get along with the other students? And what are their special needs?
I mean, you have to understand Miami-Dade is probably the America of 10, 20 years from now. We are a minority-majority district. There are already teachers, 21,000 Haitian-American children. The vast majority of our student population is Hispanic. Very strong African-American community, as well as a growing Haitian-American student population. So, we are wired naturally, to deal and teach a very diverse student population. But obviously, typical of a newly arrived group of students, yes, they will congregate together, primarily around the issue of language. But we quickly immerse them in the acculturation into the American society, the American educational system, and they adapt rather quickly. They are children. So I am not concerned about that. What I'm concerned is about the long-term impact, the shock, the psychological effects that the terrifying experience that they lived through and survived will have on their lives. I'm also concerned about the fact that everybody in our school system, children, the 21,000 Haitian children that are already here, as well as a large number of teachers who are related to somebody in Haiti who was impacted by this earthquake, the impact that will have on them for the long haul.
Many, many impacts to worry about. And Delphine, let me turn to you now. In terms of what Alberto was talking about, the impact, let's talk about the short-term impact for a minute. It's a culture shock for so many students. Let's listen to Talia Pilor, who's a Haitian high school student who recently came to the U.S. from Haiti.
Like, they do certain things that in Haiti I would never do. Like, there's no making out aloud in the hallway. There's no disrespecting the teachers. So I just go straight to my Haitian so that I know what I can talk about. Everybody else, it's like a different conversation. It's either like, okay, let's talk about drugs, let's talk about this and that, and I don't, you know, like, I'm not used to that.
Let's go straight to my Haitians. Delphine, what about that? How do you deal with it?
Well, we're, as Superintendent said, we're meeting with the students regularly, checking up to make sure that as they're going through their days and the ongoing weeks and months, that we're here for them and we're doing what's best for them at this time.
Alberto, I would think some of those values of those Haitian students would be of use to principals in Miami-Dade County.
Well, they absolutely are. I mean, this is a culture shock for them. We understand that the relationship between teachers and students in Haiti is very different than that one that often exists in our schools. But they will meet in the middle, and I think we'll be better for it. And I also think that there's a lot about the American public school system that will benefit them. You know, part of the question here is not only help.
Alberto Carvalho, sorry to cut you off. Superintendent for Miami-Dade Public County, County Public Schools, Delphine Jervis, a counselor at Miami Edison Senior High School. This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee. It happens every 4 years. One dazzling group of athletes widens our eyes and hastens our hearts by sliding down mountains and soaring through the air. Another group takes the ice with, well, brushes. I'm talking, of course, about curling, and so it seems is all of Wall Street. The water cooler chat at New York's top finance firms and investment banks is kizzle-kazzle?
What?
John, I figured you'd know what this is. Here to explain is Eric Dash, a banking reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Eric.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Good to have you. A banking reporter talking about curling. This is excellent. Okay, first of all, for those of us who are not glued to CNBC all day long, quick, what's your vision of curling? What do you think it really is, and why is it so popular on Wall Street?
Well, my vision is very much like the rest of Wall Street because I see it much the same way. It's on the background of the New York Times, on the monitors hanging above our newsroom, just like it is on the trading floor. And most people on Wall Street have been dazzled just because it's on as well.
So this is a game, as far as I can tell, where they toss something called they slide something called a stone, and then a couple of people run their brushes on the ice to make it go faster, and then what?
Right. It's almost like darts on ice, or someone described it to me as horseshoes meets housekeeping. And the goal is to sort of get the stone, as they call it, as close to the center target as possible. But nobody really knows the rules. Some people feign that they do.
Yeah, right. Well, let's take a little comic break here. Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert recently visited the U.S. Olympic curling team.
Can you touch your toes?
I can't touch my toes, no.
You cannot touch your toes.
Not really.
I want to point out that you are an Olympic athlete.
Eric, it is a bit slow. I mean, how athletic is this sport?
Well, folks on Wall Street say it's a thinking man's game. It's slow. It's about precision. It's about strategy. And as Colbert pointed out, it's about the only Olympic event that these armchair athletes could ever envision themselves competing in.
Okay, let's go to one of them. Douglas Cass, president of Seabreeze Partners, joining us from Florida. Douglas, you say curling is like drinking Merlot.
Yeah.
Okay.
I enjoy curling up with a good curling match. But in all seriousness, Eric called me, and I thought he was goofing on me. I thought one of my sons, who I watch curling, had him call me as a joke. But I enjoy the game because it's a combination of bowling. I was on my high school bowling team. Shuffleboard, billiards, bocce, chess, and checkers.
No, wait,
and
wait, wait.
I enjoy the strategy and the teamwork.
Hold on, Douglas. You enjoy those games because you like to play them. You are watching this.
No. I admire chess matches in Union Square Park in New York City as much as I admire curling, Olympic curling on CNBC.
Okay, so you can get a charge.
Plus the terms are much more, as you said, you have kizzle-kazzle, and you have all these funny terms.
Let us in on the secret. What is kizzle-kazzle?
Kizzle-kazzle, as I understand it, Eric, is that when you deliver the stone, which you throw, it's intentionally wobbled to compensate for slush or water or snow on the ice surface.
Douglas Cass, I'm sure it's really interesting. I'll give it a shot. Eric Dash from the New York Times, thanks for your help. We have, of course, been talking about curling. I know John
popular
is a big
on
curling.
Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, big
I
curling fan.
I wonder if
on
Goldman Sachs would be better curlers than Lehman Brothers.
Don't they have something better to do?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, a few weeks ago, we covered the Westminster Dog Show and held our own competition. And then the claws came out. Cat people asked, when will we get equal time on the air? Well, we'll do that.
No.
And And you, even you, John, can enter in your feline to the Takeaway Cat Show on this site, thetakeaway.org. And we'll talk about the difference between dog people and cat people in a few minutes.
Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan today, there's been a bombing attack on a hotel in Kabul. Our partner, the New York Times, is now reporting 18 dead. Afghan police say they've killed two of the attackers. A financial war brewing now. Libya has made a remarkable pronouncement. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi has called for a jihad, a holy war against Switzerland. It's after relations between Libya and Switzerland have plummeted in recent weeks. To explain, we're joined by the BBC's Sebastian Usher from London, who's been following this story. Sebastian, why a jihad against Switzerland, of all people?
Well, as you say, there's quite a background to this. A row broke out between the Swiss and the Libyans almost a couple of years ago now when one of Gaddafi's sons was arrested with his wife in a Swiss hotel. They were accused of beating up a couple of their servants. Now, the charges were dropped and they were released a couple of days afterwards. But the row, certainly from a Libyan point of view, has never gone away. And the Libyans immediately responded by... the Gaddafi family removed a large amount of its assets from Swiss bank accounts. It closed itself down to several major Swiss companies in Libya. And it also arrested two Swiss businessmen who happened to be in Libya at the time, saying that their visas weren't in order. They've been held since then. The strange thing about this is before Colonel Gaddafi made this statement yesterday, it looked like maybe things were just about to end on this because one of the Swiss businessmen had been released and the other one is just now for the first time he's serving out the few months of his sentence. So this is a bit of a shock that this has happened now, but I mean this is, as I say, a row that's been going on a long time.
Now there are 500,000 Muslims in Switzerland. Any chance they would actually listen to Muammar Gaddafi on something like this? And there is a religious dimension to this.
I really wouldn't have thought so. I mean, the issue in Switzerland is a big issue. I mean, it's a referendum that was last year on the towers, the minarets.
Building of minarets, right?
Yeah, the building of minarets. It wasn't about mosques. I mean, mosques, that's fine.
But
the minarets, basically, there's a referendum in which a small majority of Swiss said that they were against minarets being built. Now, this hasn't been brought in as law. The government has said that it's opposed to it. Muslims, obviously, there feel that this is a threat against them. But I think they're very unlikely to listen to what Colonel Gaddafi has to say. And I think, to be honest, Muslims across most of the Muslim and Arab world are unlikely to listen that closely to him. I mean, the sort of image that he has in the West as being someone, you know, who speaks very much out of turn, is almost a figure of fun.
Indeed.
That isn't that different from how he's regarded in the Muslim world.
Sebastian Usher of the BBC in London, thanks so much.
Back home, yesterday's day-long healthcare summit is the big political story. President Obama says he wants to move forward with healthcare legislation with or without Republican support. But members of the GOP say the president needs to begin from scratch. Here is Republican Senator Lamar Alexander.
Our view, with all respect, is that this is a car that can't be recalled and fixed and that we ought to start over. But we'd like to start over.
At the Olympics, the U.S. women's ice hockey team lost the gold to Canada with a 2-1 score. Here's American forward Jenny Potter.
It's a great feeling to come home with a silver medal. It's just at this point, it's disappointing because we had our standards set high. And, you know, it was a great group of women that I, you know, last 4 years trained with. And, you know, it's a little disappointing to come up short.
And if you're keeping count, yesterday at the Games, the U.S. won 1 gold medal and 3 silvers. Today we're looking forward to women's alpine skiing.
It's a snow day in New York City. Another slow-moving storm is hammering parts of the East Coast. There are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Oh, you know what that music means,
stop,
right?
Mommy.
As you probably know, our takeaway dog show, to coincide with the Westminster Kennel Club dog show, got a huge response from listeners. Hundreds of you sent in photos of your canines, and even more of you voted for the winner, a Chihuahua named Benny, who was stuck on a cat post in between two Siamese cats. Well, the only complaints we got about the contest were from cat owners who wanted in on our Pet Love Fest. So here is your chance, cat people. Send in photos of your cats for a takeaway cat show. Oh, what next, by the way? A bird show? Are we doing that next?
Cat pictures on the internet. Whoa.
You can submit photos on our Facebook site or by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And all of this got us thinking about the differences between, if you will, cat people and dog people. It turns out psychology professor Sam Gosling, who teaches at the University of Texas, has been thinking about this also. He recently completed a study that will be published later this year in the journal AnthroZoos, all about the personality traits that dog people and cat people express. Sam Gosling joins us from his home in Austin, Texas, and also joining us is the writer Emily Yaffe. She writes the Dear Prudence column for Slate and is author of the book What the Dog Did, Tales from a Formerly Reluctant Dog Owner. I think everybody sort of gets the tone of this segment here. Welcome, Sam and Emily, to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Good morning.
Emily, let me start with you. So from the title of your book, I gather you're much more of a cat person than a dog person, right?
I am a lifetime cat person who's had a beagle for 9 years.
And?
Well, let's just say that shortly after I got the beagle, I was walking her at 11 p.m. on a rainy night, and she was squatting and straining, and I realized I had to help her. I put a newspaper bag over my hand, performed surgery, and extracted from her the strap of my bra, which had gone missing a few days earlier.
She had eaten your bra.
She had eaten my bra, and in all the decades I'd had cats, I had never had to extract any of my undergarments from them.
Okay, cat versus dog. Let me play a clip that I think might very well sum up the gist of what cat people think of dog people, and tell me if you think Robert De Niro's character in Meet the Parents is on the right track.
You see, Greg, when you yell at a dog, his tail will go between his legs and cover his genitals, his ears will go down. A dog is very easy to break. But cats make you work for their affection. They don't sell out the way dogs do.
Huh. Huh, indeed. Emily, huh? Is that right?
I think it's totally true. Look, you have to train dogs. It's a lifetime of trying to shape their personality. The cat says, here I am. The training consists of, there's the litter box, guys, and then you just have to accept them on their own terms. I think cats are much more intelligent than dogs because they refuse to let their intelligence be measured.
You don't have to train houseplants either, for heaven's sakes. I hate all pets.
See, you left her speechless.
Obviously, you've never spent the night having a cat sleep on your head like a purring beret. I mean, there's just nothing better than that.
And Emily Yaffe, you've also said that dogs are like little children, cats are like teenagers. Some people might say cats are like girls and dogs are like little boys as well as big boys. Listen to this.
My name is Zachary. I'm from Colombia. I like dogs. Don't like kitties. Don't like the litter in the bathroom. I'd rather stay with a dog. They're supposed to be a man's best friends. I can go running with him, pick up a chick in the park, whatnot. You cannot do that with a kitty.
Sam Gosling, associate professor of psychology. Sum it up. What did you find? Who are the dog people? Who are the cat people?
Dog people tend to be higher on three traits from the big five personality dimensions. They tend to be higher on traits known as extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. And they tend to be the cat people tend to be higher on the traits known as neuroticism and openness. But these are very, very small differences, but they're reliable.
Is it possible to be both a dog and a cat person?
Absolutely, and neither. And those people, both sets of people, tend to fall in between the people who call themselves cat people only and dog people only.
Okay. By the way, I'm a giraffe person. Just thought I'd mention
that.
Yeah, we'll wait for the shrinks to take care of that. And listeners out there, we want to hear from you. What is the difference between dog people and cat people, if any? And for the web, listen up. Here is your chance. We are asking people to send in photos of your cats for a takeaway cat show. Submit your photos on our Facebook site or by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can submit pictures until 10 a.m. on Wednesday morning and vote after that. We will announce the winner on Friday's show.
Our thanks to Sam Gosling, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, and Emily Yaffe, who writes for Slate, is the author of the book What the Dog Did. And I don't want to hear any more tales from a formerly reluctant dog owner. You can catch up on anything you missed at The Takeaway by subscribing to our podcast and get previews on the next day's shows by going to our site and clicking blog. You know, I'm not a grump. I guess with five kids, I'm a little sort of cold on pets for the next few years.
I don't think you're a grump. Try a bird.
try a bird.
I'm serious. I always had birds growing up.
Also, how do you fix the U.S. Constitution? If you're outraged by gridlock, come up with a constitutional amendment, like no person shall be elected representative more than four times. Term limits from Keith in Massachusetts. Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Sharon for Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.